and glad you're on board.
Hey, listen, I was just calling because I wanted to make some comments on the a lot of the apprehensions that Americans have been having about the baggage checks and the heightened security that has to happen with all these terrorist attacks going on. And I think that in this country we need to have cameras in the subways or wherever we need them, because it seems like in London they're catching people. And I think it's because they have that heightened security. When I was a young man, my family, my father was in the military, and we lived in Germany in the mid-80s. And there was a terrorist attack across the street from where we lived. It was an officer's club that was blown up by some terrorists. And after that, there was heightened security. I mean, there was a lot of things that were going on that we had to do in order to maintain that. And so it just makes sense to me to do that. And I think a lot of people shouldn't worry about, you know, you get the ACLU and all these people worrying about Big Brother. But if we can use those kinds of systems to catch these guys, then we ought to do it.
Yeah, look, we've got to always balance liberty, freedom, that we all cherish more dearly, and safety and security. It's a balancing act. If the 9/11 Commission warns us that it's a matter of when, not a matter of if, and we see what happens in London, and we've got to make decisions. And I'm not saying that necessarily they're easy either.
Right.
But look, when we get on airplanes, we go through a lot of security. I don't feel like my liberties are being violated. I actually have peace of mind.
You don't have much of a mind, and your little silly caller talking about we need cameras in the subways because it seems like in London they're catching people. Yeah, like the innocent Brazilian they shot 5 times in the head. What is this silliness? And then you babble on, if we can use these systems, Big Brother systems, which you acknowledge it is, to catch guys, we should do it. Oh, you mean like you all caught the anthrax guy? Or was that part of your whole cabal? Or like you caught Uncle Ben, you know, Bin Laden? Or wait, that's part of your whole cabal, too. Like you're trying to pretend you can't catch Rove, even though he's come out and admitted that he's leaked the name of Valerie Plame, which I'm happy about, because the more you guys leak on each other, the more CIAs get their ass shot off, the easier it is for us in the end. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 Santa Cruz with Skidmark, 106.7 Illinois, 107.5 North Carolina, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, and check out the Slave Web by clicking in on your Google website, going Slave Revolt Radio. Tonight, we're going to go beyond the shadow and deal with some Onward Christian Soldiers movements and their cousins and see how these clowns are basically, with God in hand, moving the world towards destruction. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more. 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Attention seekers everywhere, I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, right where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system.
is. Beyond the shadow. And tonight, we're going to explore the Onward Christian Soldier March and how it's manifesting. Because as humanity slides deeper and deeper into an apocalyptic stupor, with large portions of the world's societies grasping on to their crucifixes, brands, Ten Commandments, hijabs, Torahs, circumcised males and females, one may ask, what does this have to do with people's mindset about war? Well, in reality, a lot. As the corporate capitalist machine in America and throughout the world drones out the tired theme of onward Christian soldiers, it's being met and engineered in its hierarchical solidarity by Zionist crusaders and jihadist doom seekers, destitute people wrapped in their flags of invisible manifest destiny tales. These flags, of course, are being waved by the corporate capital elite and the states that they thrive in, along with the propagandists and administrators for these elites. Stephen Mansfield is one such propagandist. He's the author of the book, The Faith of the American Soldier. And we're going to explore how he himself runs his Onward Christian Soldiers game. So first, let's check out how he outlines how it's a new day of faith in America. Check this out.
This war is greatness. Amazing time. Evanescence singing Wake Me Up Inside, Save Me From the Nothing That I've Become. You can open business magazines and find articles about archaeological discoveries confirming the Gospels. It's just a whole new day of culture, a whole new day of emphasis on faith in our culture. And the millennials, of course, have grown up in the midst of that. So they surprise us in that, first of all, they've become so effective, arisen to their more noble selves. As I say sarcastically in the book, it may be that they have had been given an opportunity to fight for something more than just a parking space at the mall. But the fact is that there's a more noble version of them that has arisen, and it's very integrated with faith. Now, the millennials are, without question, all the surveys show, very turned towards faith, very turned towards religion, but of a very non-traditional type. They are a bit postmodern. They want God, but they don't want church. They think, according to most surveys, that many churches are just pastor cults and are irrelevant to their lives. So they want faith. They want God. They want, in some cases, the Bible. About 60% of them are in some form Christian, according to some of the surveys. But they're not interested in traditional structures. They're not interested in faith as it has been done. They're more likely to be sitting five people around a table over a latte at Starbucks reading Purpose Driven Life than they ever are to darken the door of a church.
Okay, this is the same and normal optimistic type of spin that you would expect from a hocus-pocus person. You know, first he talks about how there's been archaeological findings on, you know, various religious historical aspects. I mean, that doesn't really mean anything except that human beings have been steeped in hocus-pocusism and sorcery for thousands of years. All right, so what else is new? I mean, you know, Mansfield has another agenda that's tied in with all of this. And next, he tries to piece it all together in, of course, the imperial sphere of things. Because as Mansfield goes on about the millennial generation in war, he tries to fit it all in.
So now, these millennials go to war. And they take this sort of non-traditional, unstructured, postmodern faith with them onto the battlefield. And here's where we now have the next area of collision, and that is the battlefield itself. War has always, throughout history, pressed religious questions into the lives of those who fight them. People don't realize it, but war is not sort of the John Wayne, I did it my way, you know, tough guy kind of experience. Most wars press soldiers up against faith and press religious questions into their lives. This really should make sense to us. When a soldier goes to war, what happens? He has to have a moral rationale for killing the other side. He or she faces his or her own death, experiences the death of those around them. In other words, all of these things, the distance from home, the break from community, all of this is going to press religious questions into the lives of soldiers. All the more this war, where we have an enemy that is essentially a religious network and that makes a moral case against the war, against our forces. But this has always been the case. The American Civil War, for example, as you may know, down here a little bit more in the South, the American Civil War, literally the direction of the war was changed by the revivals that were going on in the camps, both North and South, and by the way that soldiers turned to faith. So wars have always been times of spiritual transformation for soldiers, always been times of religious conflict and religious growth and deepening and searching. But this war in particular is pressing that because, again, our enemy is a religious network that is saying to us constantly, you are the great Satan, you are immoral, you are not a people of God, you are the decadent West, and we fight you on religious terms. So this forces question the faith and the lives of the millennials.
All right, you can see what he's doing, which is pretty savage. You know, when he defines who the U.S. Empire is fighting and defines it as essentially a religious network, I mean, that's really not definable. That's extremely esoteric in the same way this whole bit about a war on terror. What does that mean? See, there's no real for him, that's intentional. For his rulers, that's intentional because they don't want to bring up the class nature and structure that they operate within. That essentially this is about resources and control of resources. And control of dollarism versus euro, you know, the euro dollar versus the U.S. dollar, to bring that back into fold, to expand its the U.S. hegemony, to control a vital energy resource so that you can keep in check your capitalist competitors throughout the world. So a resource war tied into the capitalist global structure is at the core of this. So you have a situation where these charlatans do not want to define things as they really are. They want to get mystical. And religion plays a role in people not critiquing things on a serious class objective type of level where things is good and bad. Yet here you have soldiers who for the U.S. Empire who along with their population were tricked, lied, and deceived, some willingly, about the reason why the U.S. was going over there in the first place, the whole weapons of mass destruction. This was obvious before the first cowboy boots even stomped on Iraqi soil. It's beyond clear now. The Downing Street memo and everything have not put the nail in the last coffin. That's already been done. But thrown the last bit of dirt over the grave. So you have a situation where the deceitfulness and manipulation by the rulers has been thoroughly exposed. But see, Mansfield and company don't want the soldiers to think on those particular lines. Are you as a soldier being used? What about any kind of principles as far as people's sovereignty? people's right to self-determination. Man still doesn't want that type of critique. He wants the soldiers, the onward Christian soldiers, to just get caught up in this kind of a religious enemy network versus us. And since you as a quote-unquote Christian or whatever hocus-pocus isms you throw out there see yourself as a good, decent person, those who are opposing you obviously must be on the other side of the coin that you must fight. And he gets into all of this ridiculous type of stuff, like when he says that using religion, talking about how the direction of the Civil War was turned by the revival of faith, North and South. The reality is black folks are the ones who changed the direction in the course of the war. When 200,000 plus black people picked up the gun for the North to crush the South, the party was over. Lincoln himself admitted that if it wasn't for the black soldiers, the North would have lost the war. That was the decisive turning point, not some fool's head in the Bible. And on top of that, if one looks into the Civil War and some of the things that were going on, you would have seen instances where, you know, there was a high rate of venereal diseases going amongst the troops, from the various soldiers to the prostitutes, so on and so forth. So basically what happened was the army started to set up a clinic, not only for the soldiers, but for the prostitutes themselves. In other words, they knew they were prostitutes. But they weren't trying to pass any kind of moral judgment. They were concerned about the safety of their fighting force. And if protecting the health of their soldiers meant protecting the health of the prostitutes, they were going to do it. Moral Christian ethics aside. I mean, that's the real world. These types of things were deeply embedded within the Civil War once the high rates of venereal diseases were going on. See, but Mansfield wouldn't get into any of this because he wants to get into this mythological type of, you know, religious morality thing. So this all just kind of sums up to the type of game he's trying to play in the D-class type of analysis he wants people on. He talks about how war has always pressed religious questions. Well, to the Gumps, that's an easy way out. If you're not questioning things on the human rights of people, the self-determination of people, the indigenous rights of people, and that all of these can be stumped on and over with some kind of hocus-pocus supremacy jargon, some kind of manifest destiny type of thing. So Mansfield also mentions that, you know, in times of war, people need a moral rationale for killing because they face death themselves, and this presses religious types of issues, you know, and a moral justification, etc., etc. But this once again helps expose how religious morality and human rights don't go hand in hand, because all types of chaos is being done by the U.S. occupiers, and it doesn't matter how religious you claim you are. The fact of the matter is that if you're over there fighting for the interest, which it is, of a ruling elite in America, then all claims of having any kind of morality are obviously kicked to the curb. See, this is a classic example of how these mystics use their religion for people to not look at these types of issues as a form of class warfare, global expansionism by elites to control energy systems, to control other nation states, their competitors. It's reduced to my God's better than your God. And it exposes, once again, the harmful effect of this type of sorcery mentality. So, let's check out next as Mansfield goes into how the war is forcing the millennials to question issues. What kind of questions? Well, I guess we'll hear.
Have the collision now of the millennials, who are this seeking, hungry, God-hungry, but non-traditional, unstructured generation, going to war, going onto the battlefield now, this other collision direction, and the war is asking them questions, forcing them to deepen, forcing them to go further in their spiritual seeking. It's interesting that somehow whatever's happening over there, we can talk about that in your questions if you like, somehow what's happening over there is causing them to arise to something more magnificent. I think it's going to be one of the great stories to come out of the war. A British journalist said to me as I was flying out of Baghdad with him on a Royal Air Force C-130, this British journalist had lived in America and had been new American film, and said, you know, I came over here expecting Debbie Does Dallas and Animal House. What I found was Saving Private Ryan and Braveheart. That was his way of saying, I came over here expecting to find American party animals at war. Instead, I found very, very noble young soldiers. And so this collision of the battlefield with the spiritually seeking but rather suspect generation is producing something magnificent.
Once again, this is more mystical jargon. When he's saying that, this one British guy, you know, said that he was expecting basically to see Animal House when he got over there, but he saw Saving Private Ryan and Braveheart, all one has to say is Abu Ghraib, the depleted uranium episode that's being spewed out throughout the landscape, the shock and awe maneuvering that took place, the carpet bombing of Fallujah, the shooting at ambulance drivers, the shooting at journalists, the collective guilt type of arresting against the Iraqi population. This is not any kind of noble type of group or individuals. This represents individuals who are within the matrix of a corporate military machine that has a particular agenda, and their duty as G.I. Joe soldiers is to follow through with that particular agenda. That's the real world. And as brutally cold and committed to the domination of resources for their elite capitalist gains, those who fight for that elite class will be nothing more than representatives of those policies and goals. So you can personally have a quote-unquote decent, demeanor and a decent quote-unquote personal personality on how you deal with people in general. But when you put on that uniform and go out and fight for the empire, Christianized, Islamicized, Hebronicized or not, it means nothing, because your soul is now wrapped within the flag of the elite empire. So when he talks about millennials are spiritually seeking but somewhat suspect generation, suspect about what? I mean, because if there was a healthy suspicion going on, then what Boy George has done and company have done concerning the weapons of mass destruction, the 9/11 deception, etc., etc., there would be a firestorm, representative amongst that population. But instead, what you have basically is kind of a this go along to come along. Now, of course, you have a drop in people willing to go to this particular war, but that's not from any kind of spiritual awakening. That's more from the fact that people see that they're getting their ass shot off, and that this is not going to be some kind of cakewalk where you're going to be coming back after a couple of months with some medals, you know, pinned to your chest, playing a war hero game. As a matter of fact, you may end up in one of our West Oakland head coffins. That's what may be in store for you. So he goes on to talk about how you know, what, like, the British guy thought what they witnessed was something very noble within the soldiers. See, this is how people get caught up in imagery. See, religious people love pomp and imagery and stuff like that because it's style over substance. It's imagery over substance. And so someone can go through all of these kind of humble types of imagery, you know, praying and kneeling and all of that, and that gives the whole imagery that someone thinks of an entity higher than themselves, and they're willing to submit to this and all of that type of stuff. And this resonates amongst a lot of idiots within this world population, but it's symbolic if at the same time these same people are carrying out dastardly deeds for the particular entities that they represent. If you it's like there are a number of people who could be dressed in like very modest outfits, hijabs, whatever. And if you go by the campus, you know, at the University of Berkeley, you'll see people, you know, in you know, the hijab, you know, the headdress and this and that. And you know, many of them talk about it's a form of modesty and it's within their religion. But the vast majority of them that you come across believe in the capitalist system. Now, there's nothing more vulgar and inhumane and vulturistic and obscene than the capitalist system. So if you support the capitalist system, you basically support the McDonaldization of the world. You support empire building. You support expansionism. You support imperialism, because all of those things go hand in hand. So the fact that, you wrap yourself up and you're all covered up does not represent anything but your own personal quote-unquote taste and symbolism. But symbols and imagery is not real. Not when it comes to the class, particular issues and things like that that really determine do other human beings throughout the planet have a right for a clean cup of water, and for the elites of the world, and for many people who align themselves with the elites of the world, the question is, or the answer is, no. Now, next, Mansfield goes into America's religious conflicts as he sees it. Check this out.
The third force that is the third trend that is affecting this whole subject, and that I try to treat in the book, is this whole issue of America being religiously in conflict with herself. A given Supreme Court rulings since World War II, we are a country unquestionably founded with a religious orientation. There's not much question, regardless of where you are religiously or spiritually. That America was founded by people who were largely Christian in some form. Even the Thomas Jeffersons hearkened to the Bible and spoke in Christian terms, though they didn't consider themselves Orthodox Christians. No question that was our founding. But since the Second World War, the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment to say, although it's been a bit unclear, that state funding ought not to exist for the purposes of religion. Well, the ACLU, of course, has taken that and begun to try to remove state-supported faith of whatever kind. My issue is not whether that's legitimate or not at this point. My issue is that it's a trend, that this whole issue that we battle with all the time, whether it's God in the pledge or prayer at football games or whether there ought to be congressional chaplains or whether we ought to have religious inscriptions on our buildings or whether the Ten Commandments ought to be in the state house or the courthouse in Alabama, all of those issues stem from this contemporary reading of the First Amendment. And this is affecting the military as well. The ACLU has successfully filed a lawsuit against Virginia Military Institute to remove a required prayer time that has traditionally been held there and required of the cadets. Again, saying you cannot, with state funds, require religious observances among people who essentially are, I think it's fair to say, are planning careers in the American military or with state funds. There have also been threats of lawsuits against West Point and against Annapolis. As a matter of fact, back in the 1970s, two Harvard law students decided to file a lawsuit, the goal of which was to have the American military chaplaincy ruled unconstitutional. And many legal experts believe that had they not run out of money, they probably would have been successful. Now again, you see the tension that America is in with herself, with her own founding. Because it was the very generation that wrote the First Amendment that established military chaplaincies and congressional chaplaincies. So we are a nation in conflict with our past and in conflict with ourselves religiously. And of course, I'll be happy to answer questions on this if you'd like, but nothing points to that like the swirl of opinion around George W. Bush's faith. Is he violating the First Amendment by praying in the Oval Office? Is he a religious nut who gives his prayer list sometimes to journalists? You follow what I'm saying? This when he's asked who his favorite political philosopher is, and he says Jesus Christ because he changed my heart. Is he in some way breaking down a traditional wall of separation between religion and public policy? So these are the three forces that have come into collision. That we have the secularizing trend and this battle over the role of faith in our public life. We have the battlefield and its religious nature given our enemy. And we have this millennial generation that is spiritually seeking.
All right, this once again exposes how this guy is a charlatan. In many ways, you know, the show I did last week on Jefferson, Madison, and separation of church and state kind of meshes with this, because this guy is throwing out incredibly deceptive and non-backed by historical facts types of statements and stuff when he goes into how the very first generation that wrote the First Amendment established the military, you know, chaplain type of stuff and all of that, and how it's unquestionable that this country was founded on religious orientation. This is all a mixture of words and stuff. President John Adams, June 10th, 1797, concerning the Treaty of Tripoli. This at Tripoli was is now called Libya. It was a Muslim government then, and the Islamic society was running around invading or at least pirating ships and stuff. And the U.S. Government wanted to make it clear, saying, "Don't use the fact that you think we're Christian," which is, some of the excuses you guys use to raid other ships. Don't use that as an excuse to raid our ships. And the treaty that was signed by President John Adams stated, quote, "The government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion," unquote. So this was a treaty that signed, and once it's signed, that's official law of the land. Now, also, within the First Amendment, it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So this guy is basically just a charlatan when he tries to pretend that there's some kind of debate or conflict or and things like that. As a matter of fact, we have a situation where, you know, as you know, like last week, I featured Lenny Brenner, who's the one who wrote the book on Jefferson Madison's separation of church and state. And Brenner went into the whole aspect of Jefferson and Madison's position on, you know, these invisible kingdoms and all of that type of stuff, and their position on the separation of church and state, which they were really committed to. In other words, it didn't matter so much, like, to Jefferson if you were, you know, religious, but they didn't want it tied within their vision of the nation state. Well, once again, here's Brenner talking about what James Madison wrote concerning, and this is the author of the Bill of Rights, concerning issues of separation of church and state, and some of these issues that this guy Mansfield was trying to distort. Check this out.
Now, but listen to this. This is by the guy, James Madison, who is the author of the Bill of Rights, the author of the First Amendment, nothing less than that. And he asks, is the appointment of chaplains to the two houses of Congress consistent with the Constitution and the pure principle of religious freedom? And then he answers his own question. In strictness, the answer on both questions must be in the negative. The Constitution of the U.S. forbids everything like an establishment of a national religion. The law appointing chaplains establishes a religious worship for the national representatives to be performed by ministers of religion elected by a majority of them, and these are to be paid out of the national taxes. Does not this involve the principle of a national establishment applicable to a provision for a religious worship of the constituents as well as of the representative body, approved by the majority and conducted by the ministers of religion, paid by the entire nation? In other words, he's saying that in strictness, chaplains in the House of Representatives and the Senate are unconstitutional.
Okay.
All right? Because they violate separation, church, and state. But then he goes further. Listen to this. Better also disarm in the same way the precedence of chaplainships of the Army and the Navy than erect them into a political authority in matters of religion. In other words, he is against having paid teachers,
right,
in the military. In other words, his attitude was, hey, if a bunch of guys on the ship are Christian, you know, Protestant Christians, they can pick one of their own guys and he can do all the ministering, you know.
Right.
But the government of the United States should not be appointing him a minister.
Hmm.
All right? Now, this is a guy who wrote the Bill of Rights.
There you have it. It's clear that Madison himself was saying, look, we don't even want chaplains within the military. Now, if some guys want to get together, you know, who are in the military and appoint someone, you know, that's fine. You know, appoint someone to be kind of, you know, the one that discusses it or leads the discussion group. He doesn't have a problem with that. But anything that's ordained by the state, the author of the Bill of Rights said this is unconstitutional. So when you hear Mansfield blather on about how there's a conflict, a current conflict, when the authors of the Constitution and Bill of Rights objected to what he's trying to act like is a current conflict, but they were opposed to it back then, and they were the authors, it shows how deeply embedded into the art of being a charlatan that cats like Mansfield are. I mean, this is just hideous and stuff. It just shows how barbaric and how lack of respect that they have for the history that they claim. These are ideologues. They're pushing through their particular agenda, and they're trying to create an imagery of something that just isn't there. They have their own objectives, and they cloak themselves around religion and justice and democracy and all of that hoopla. But at the same time, they're deeply embedded in the capitalist market system, which exposes their true soul. Now, next, Mansfield goes into what he found in the American G.I. Joe when he got in bed with them.
So, just after Christmas this last year, I went to Iraq by the good graces of the chaplains of the Third Corps, and of course the Pentagon, gave me permission to be embedded for a short while with the troops over there. And my goal was to find out what's happening to them religiously, what's happening in their lives. And what I found was not something I had expected. Everybody I talked to was making some sort of journey towards a deeper faith. That was not an a priori assumption on my part. That was not an assumption that I had made, and therefore was concluded or used the evidence to confirm. My discussions with soldiers verified that they are deeply pursuing God as they understand Him, that they are influenced by the network of soldiers around them, that they are moving towards faith. And it really is a new day on the battlefield. A soldier can listen to the sermon preached in his home church back in Tennessee within hours of it being preached, because the tech guy at the church loads it on the church website, and soldiers have access to the internet, of course. Soldiers are engaged in purpose-driven life groups in their tents and in their trailers. They are studying the Bible. They're using downloads from everybody from the Dalai Lama to T.D. Jakes. They have access to the internet, and so technology often feeds this growth of faith. But it's a soldier's kind of networking that you find. The chaplains are critical and they're important. I'll talk about them in just a moment. But in the field, you find that almost every soldier is in some way moving towards faith, and he's influenced by a network of soldiers around him or her. And normally, this begins to move towards the sort of rituals that soldiers like. Soldiers are busy, they don't have a lot of time, they're under fire, and what they want to know is that God is with them. What they want to know is that God is near. As one soldier said, when I walked up to him and I said, "Well, what do you really want?" He said, "Sir, I want to know that Jesus is in my effing Humvee." You know, that was the way he expressed it. You know what? It's okay with me if they're a little raw. They have a right to be. But my point is, they want the presence and the nearness of God. And so they engage in rituals that are not empty, but everything from the quoting of scripture to prayer times to group confessions of a truth or something of that nature. And sometimes it becomes rather humorous to me. I was sitting with one Humvee driver who was a Baptist. And he did not start his Humvee, and I waited and asked him why. He refused to start his Humvee until a female Hispanic Catholic sergeant made the sign of the cross over his Humvee. Baptist driver now. And I said, "What's this about?" He said, "Listen, no one who's ever had the sign of the cross made over their vehicle by this sergeant has failed to come home. I'm waiting for her to make the sign of the cross." Well, this Baptist soldier's pastor back home must have his head spinning around, you know, at the thought of his congregation member waiting for this Catholic sergeant to make the sign of the cross. He didn't care. Soldiers are boiling faith down to what works. That's really the issue. What works? What's real? And I have to tell you, I'm a Christian, but I was challenged by the cutting edge, bare bones, suck the marrow out of the faith, live it real way that these soldiers are living faith. I mean, it's really a no holds barred thing that is fashioned in the face of battle, and I found it deeply inspiring.
All right, once again, you have this, you know, when Mansfield talks about how, you know, this one soldier was waiting for, the Catholic soldier was waiting for this female soldier But this one Baptist soldier was waiting for the Catholic soldier to cross his Humvee and all of that. This is just, these are just witch doctors. These are just people who are doing little rituals and stuff like that. And, superstitious stuff. And they see it at least temporarily working for them. The dude may not even be alive right now. So they just go with it. It's no different than a baseball, on a baseball team. Where you have a team and the team has been in a slump. And then, game, everyone explodes and is hitting real well. So then the people on the team start going over, did anyone do anything different? And one guy says, well, usually I don't eat 2 or 3 hours before a game, but today I decided to go out and get a hamburger at such and such place right before the game, an hour before the game, which I never do. So then the next thing you know, everyone on the team wants him to go get a hamburger an hour before the next game. And if they do well that game, the following games, and they just keep stuffing it down them. And then others may even join in and start getting hamburgers an hour before the game, even if they don't eat hamburgers on a regular basis and stuff. I mean, so that's all that's going on there. You got guys who are in a traumatic, situation, and they're grasping on any type of superstition and myth that they can hold on to give them confidence of getting out of the particular situation that they're in. But see, none of this addresses a right or wrong. So it's basically harmless in a baseball game because, you're just playing baseball. But if you're occupying someone's land and you don't raise these types of questions of what am I doing there, and is it justified me doing there, being there, killing people, et cetera, et cetera, then it shines a whole new light. So, it ends up being that these basically are religious drones with no sense of right or wrong, no humanitarian principle. They're just fighting for who Master tells them to fight for without question. Now, this is why, as I've often stated, how elites throughout the world play this particular game. You see the Zionists in Israel do this. So it's not really a question of occupation for many of the Zionist soldiers and stuff. They refer back to some kind of, original mythical homeland that the Palestinians who are there don't even accept. But it doesn't matter because it comes down to power, and the Zionist state, the elites, anchor their justification of expansion and domination based off of a religion that other people don't even adhere to. By the same token, the genocidal policies that are taking place in the Sudan. Here you have a situation where the National Islamic Front, the government in control in Khartoum, has mixed in, which is what traditionally happens with Christopher Columbuses with turbans on, or Christopher Columbuses with cowboy boots on, like in Iraq. They mix in their particular identity, in this case in Sudan, an Arabic identity, along with the religion. Now, even though the majority of cats in Darfur, the black population in Darfur, is Muslim, they don't consider themselves Arab. But within this kind of Islamic fundamentalism that has developed, kind of like in the Christian identity movement, you have a situation where claiming an Arab identity, real or imagined, brings you closer to God or Allah. Because within that context, since Muhammad, who's the Islamic's, the Islam's prophet, since he was Arab, claiming an Arab lineage brings you closer to the religion and a pure form of identity and stuff. Now, so when you have a warped regime like the one in control in Sudan, the National Islamic Front, this takes on genocidal types of proportions. So the Nuba Mountains, where the majority of the population, the Nubas, don't are black, are African, and don't consider themselves either Arab or Muslim, concentration camps and rehabilitation centers have been erected, literally, to basically wipe out the population and or its identity, to Arabicize it, you know, have them bowing down to Islam, having them speak Arabic as their primary language, having them go through Arab dress and customs and stuff. In Darfur, where the population is black but Muslim, Arabic is not its primary language. So here you have an elite that basically for the most part wants to control the population and its land and resources. And the best way to control the land and resources of population is to to homogenize it. In other words, to McDonaldize it. In other words, the same way that you see the McDonaldization of the planet taking place in America, where everyone, where the empire is trying to bring it under the American type of fold, the Western values, so on and so forth, as a better way of being able to market itself, control, expand its influence, is the same way that these little petty neo-capitalist regimes on the Islamic tip, like the one in the Sudan, are trying and have been trying for centuries in their own particular way. So here they use the Arabism and Islamism to expand and control and to dominate and decimate the population. Now the elite wants the land, the resources, so on and so forth, because people with other languages, cultures, identities, way of thinking may not buy into your whole market particular strategy and have another way of looking at the world. But if you can bring them into your Arabic identity fold by raping large portions of the population, and if a male, this is the way the game is played out, if a male rapes a woman and she has a kid by it, then if that male is Arab or considers themselves Arab, then that kid is Arab. You know, so there's kind of like this Arab supremacy gene through a male hierarchy. All of these things are playing into what's going on into the Sudan at this particular time. And the Sudanese government is at the forefront of pushing through this particular policy. So in the same way that you had this onward Christian soldier movement, you had this onward Islamic soldier, you know, the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on. Now, the Arabs in the Sudan are not any more indigenous to the Sudan, formerly Nubia, than an American G.I. Joe is to Iraq. Once again, the breaking down people's historical memory is all part of the occupation theory. Here's a civilization, Nubia, that existed before ancient Egypt, the first pharaonic lineage. The concept of pharaohs was developed in Nubia, in Taseri, Questal. Here, the first forms of hieroglyphic writing were developed in Nubia. Nubia existed, and the Kush region was in existence before ancient Egypt commit, and was in existence after the fall of ancient Egypt. And it only came to an end with the invasion and occupation of the Islams, and the expansion of the Islams, the occupation of the Islams, increased the power of those of that particular persuasion. And this whole Arab identity aspect plays within that. This, so you can see the type of genocidal mentality that can develop and does develop by occupiers and expanders. One of the administrators for the Sudanese government, when talking about, after all, they created all of this disruption, the Nuba Mountain genocide campaign with concentration camps, the genocide going on in the West, in Darfur, the 20-year civil war that took place in the South. Everywhere you turn, the regime has been at a genocidal war with large portions of the population. And part of that is because the majority of the population does not see itself as Arab. Regardless of the religion, they see themselves as indigenous black, you know, people, as indigenous Africans. And the minority of the population is using force to try to eradicate that particular problem. So you can see the crusader mentality that goes along with this whole aspect. Also, you know, Carol Shahidi, she's the author who wrote Big Little White Lies. She's an Arab American and one of the few, you know, who's really honest on these types of subjects of race and things like that. She wrote an article called The Color of Genocide. And one thing that I'm going to mention about or what she said was that she states that my brothers and sisters in the Middle Eastern and North African motherland are not doing a much better job than their weak reaction to Darfur than my new brothers and sisters are in America. After all, the Darfurians are as pious as the Muslims in Mecca. Incidentally, those inhabitants of the Middle East and North Africa who are Christian and Jewish also have bloody hands when it comes to their exploitation of Africa. Like Muslims, Arabs, they have yet to mobilize a powerful united front to help Darfur. Despite all the differences between the Arab world and the Western world, they have one thing in common. Both sides have enriched themselves from Africa by exploiting every imaginable resource, most notably slaves. Where they didn't exploit and enslave, they colonialized. Where they did not colonialize, they set up segregated communities where they exploited the mercantile aspect of economics. Afterwards, they never bothered to close the gates of hell they opened. Since then, the devil himself has come out of those gates and found a new home amongst international political criminals. So that's just a small thing about what she had to say. And, you know, this gets into the aspect of that whole particular type of mentality of the onward Christian, the onward Islam, the onward Hebron soldier, when they are fighting in the name of their imperial expansionist states. And it shows the savagery and the complicity of those particular religions who turn a blind eye because these people are doing it in the name of their God, and they don't want it to be seen as weakening the credibility of their God or challenging it or some ethnic identity type thing as far as Arab expansionism or whatever. But next, let's go back to Mansfield as he goes into these American onward Christian soldiers code. Let's check out this code. Dig this.
I stood and watched and wrote notes as soldiers gathered in circles and sang little bits of hymns and held their hearts and sometimes their weapons before God and prayed the Lord's Prayer and in one case very movingly sang Be Thou My Vision. Another soldier who had sort of completed half of seminary before feeling like he was called to go to war after 9/11 had told them that this was what the Crusaders used to sing, and it was an ancient hymn that soldiers had sung for generations, so they sang those verses with gusto, basically fashioning their own version of a warrior's code, a warrior's faith, a warrior's offering of him or herself before God. It's very, very moving.
All right, once again, this gets to the sick nature, you know, nature of what these guys are all about. When they're talking about singing what the Crusaders used to sing and this warrior's code and all of that type of stuff, their sense of honor is just basically wrapped around them doing quote-unquote God's mission. But the God's mission is basically defined essentially by the elites of their particular society. The elites of America, the elites of Saudi Arabia, the elites of the Sudan, the elites of Israel, etc., etc. That identity becomes wrapped in within the nation state and the elites. And their God becomes within that as far as an identity, power, expansionism. Now, General William Boykin, he's known as the Christian General, who heads U.S. military intelligence. He was dressed up in his, you know, full military uniform and all of that type of stuff. And he spoke to around 23 evangelical groups around the country, you know, proclaiming that America was a quote-unquote Christian nation. Now, we've already dealt with that on the last, you know, this and last show especially. But this is what he had to say, this general, quote, "We in the army of God, in the house of God, kingdom of God, have been raised for such a time as this. Our spiritual enemy will only be defeated if we come against them in the name of Jesus," unquote. So once again, you see these clowns, he's like Mansfield, mixing in hocus pocusism with some kind of genuine, justifiable quest. Now, it's not a question of, is this imperial invasion? It's all wrapped around this kind of crusader's warrior God code, with no class, humanitarian questions being asked whatsoever. So you have these Christian crusaders with no human rights principles, Sam. Islamic crusaders, no human rights principles, Sudan. Islamic Zionist crusaders, no human rights principles, Israel. And you can see how in all of these areas, massive amounts of human rights abuses are being done. And many people of those faiths turn a blind eye from it because of how those states wrap themselves in part around religion, and how those people who want to increase their power continue to use this crusader religion mentality by knowing that many people will not want to denounce on principle what they're doing because it's wrapped within, you know, this identity of religion and, you know, and often ethnicity wrapped within that, you know, Jewish ethnicity, is Arab Islamic ethnicity, etc., etc. This shows you how harmful and damaging this whole religious code and stuff is really all about, and how it plays itself out. But next, Mansfield goes into Uncle Ben, goes into Uncle Osama bin Laden type of stuff, as he talks about more of this faith-based warrior code. Check this out.
What I advocate in the book, and what I am concerned with in the book, is our soldiers allowed to integrate their faith into what they do in the profession of arms? I am grappling with this issue of a faith-based warrior code. In fact, I start the book with the Knight's Vigil and the kind of a creative description about how the medieval knights used to go through a vigil before they were actually knighted. And they would hold their armor before God, and they would commit themselves to the kind treatment of civilians and kind treatment of captured enemy, and they would commit themselves to a warrior code. Now, there were excesses, of course, in the Middle Ages and with the knighthood, but it still was one of the closest examples that I could find in history of an attempt in Western history to integrate faith into some kind of a martial or a warrior code. And I found that many of these soldiers were hoping for that. They were grappling with that. The best example of that for me was what happened at Abu Ghraib, or Abu Ghraib, as some say. And let me tell you that little backstory of faith and talk about a few more things, then I'll take your questions. Abu Ghraib has a faith backstory that is often not told, And I think it's critical because it shows the need for this warrior code. When the original unit was in there, the unit from West Virginia that you heard so much about because there have been the trials and the allegations and so on, there was a female Asian chaplain who was assigned to them late. She wasn't part of their original unit. And she was told, according to Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Taylor, she was told, stay out of the way, don't be intrusive, stay in your quarters, let the soldiers come to you. Well, as a result, there was no moral presence. There was very little ministry going on. Chapel attendance was low. Morale was low. It wasn't a good experience. And for that and other reasons, I think the abuses took place. When that unit was removed and a new unit came in from Ohio, Colonel Taylor told the chaplains, look, I want you there all the time. I want you there at prisoner exchanges. I want you there when prisoners are interrogated. I want you there at shift changes. We're going to do ministry by presence, as he called it. We're going to be a constant influence. Well, you can imagine, the morale increased. The moral environment increased. Chapel attendance shot up from 10 or 15, I think I was told, into the hundreds for a facility that I think had about 1,500 people in it, at one time anyway. And the soldiers now carry a little medallion in their pocket that says, has a slogan, Restoring America's Honor. And so I see Abu Ghraib as kind of almost a symbol, an argument for the case that I hope I'm making in the book gently, which is admiration for the military, but the need for a faith-based warrior code. Whatever faith soldiers are of, they need to have the ability and the help to integrate that faith into a warrior code that gives them a noble vision for the profession at arms, that empowers them to serve faithfully, but also gives them the boundaries of a moral code. How do you treat civilians? How do you treat POWs? Things of that nature. And I want to suggest that we look at this compassionately. I'm sure that everybody sitting here watching me, and both in the room and on television, would think of themselves as fairly moral, upright people. I mean, very few people are walking around thinking of themselves as immoral people. But put us on the battle line, on the front line. Deprive us maybe of some sleep and make our meals hurried, if not infrequent, although the military does a great job with feeding the soldiers. Kill a few of our best friends. Have us constantly under stress. Have us constantly under the threat of death. And I don't mean to be too graphic here, but have the Iraqi child that we shared candy with the day before horribly blown up right before our eyes by insurgents. Have all those factors work on us, and we might be tempted to conduct that some would call barbaric. We might just be a few steps away from, call it what you want, inappropriate conduct, barbaric conduct. I want to suggest that war pushes people to their extreme. And at Abu Ghraib, I have to say, and I'm not qualified to speak to the legal issues, but Abu Ghraib was a tough situation for those soldiers. They were under bombardment while they were guarding some of the most difficult of prisoners. It was a tough situation. And what was needed at that moment of crisis, at that moment when they were tired and they were hungry and they were fed up and maybe they were conflicting orders, so we've understood in the trials and things of that nature, what did they need? They needed the moral and spiritual reinforcement of a warrior code that guided them in their conduct as soldiers, that reminded them of who they were, that they needed the reminding that they were committed, theoretically committed, to a noble warrior code that again told them how to treat POWs, told them how to conduct themselves under duress, told them how to treat civilians, etc. I think Abu Ghraib is, in a sense, a breakdown of that moral reinforcement that soldiers constantly need to have. And I don't mean to blame any particular chaplain. I think it was a systemic breakdown, and that's been pretty much admitted. But we need to remember the faith part of this.
All right, once again, it just shows how much of a charlatan this guy is. You know, he talks about how he feels that the Abu Ghraib thing is representative of the no moral presence at Abu Ghraib. All one has to say is, well, what's the excuse for Guantanamo? What's the excuse for the School of the Americas? I mean, this is just ridiculous. But it just shows how he's just basically a hocus-pocus imperial charlatan. And he uses this type of imagery and stuff where he wants people to wrap themselves around the flag and God, you know, as part of the warrior code, without questioning what is it that these individuals are getting themselves into, who benefits, and what principles do I hold? And are they in violation to my own personal principles? if your principles are basically just to go out and kill whoever the elites tell you to kill without questioning, as long as you have a crucifix or, you know, a Quran shoved up your behind, then you're basically an imperial dog. You're garbage. You know, and that's what this guy represents. This type of stuff is not anything new. You know, this is what another person who kind of had this kind of warrior code had to say. Quote, "Hence today I believe that I am acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty, Creator. By defending myself against the Jew, I am fighting for the work of the Lord." Unquote. Adolf Hitler. That's that was his statement. Old Hitler also said this, quote, "My feelings as a Christian points me to my Lord and Savior as a fighter. It points me to the man who once in loneliness, surrounded by a few followers, recognized that Jews for what they were and summoned men to fight against them, and who, God's truth, was greatest not as a sufferer, but as a fighter. In boundless love as a Christian and as a man, I read through the passage which tells us how the Lord at last rose in his might and seized the scourge to drive out the temple, the brood of vipers and adders. How terrific was his fight for the world against the Jewish poison. Today, after 2,000 years, with deepest emotion, I have recognized more profoundly than ever before the fact that it was for this that he had to shed his blood upon the cross. As a Christian, I have no duty to allow myself to be cheated, but I have the duty to be a fighter for truth and justice. And if there is anything which could demonstrate that we are acting rightly, it is the distress that daily grows. For as a Christian, I have also a duty to my own people." Unquote. That was Hitler again in a speech on April 12, 1922. So here, all of these crusaders use this type of nonsense. And they get into this kind of, you know, warped purity type stuff. You know, just like I was mentioning before, like when all the chaos was created and is being created by the Islams in the Sudan, one of the administrators, when a lot of people were dislocated from their particular regions in the south and other places, west, and were migrated into Khartoum, one of the Arab Islams for the government of Khartoum complained that these people were messing up the purity of Arab Khartoum. So all of this identity slash religious type stuff gets mixed in. They have a history of this kind of final solution philosophy and working with one another. As I mentioned before, one time, Albana, who was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, he was from Egypt, he offered his services to Hitler during World War II, and he saw, you know, I mean, it was just this kind of, you know, Islamic superiority, Arabic superiority, identity, nationalistic mentality. Stern Gang, which was a Zionist operation of Jews, they offered their services to Hitler. So here you have these people who see themselves and their particular identity as being supreme above others, and they relate to what Hitler was doing. And had no problem in joining forces with that type of particular element and stuff. This shows the type of corrosiveness that is going on and how it plays itself out. Now, you know, in essence, what I'm saying is I don't really care what religion you squeeze out of your behind. Just, you know, wipe after you're done. Don't try to, you know, squeeze all that stuff all over the place to where you want it within all elements of society and stuff like that, because we know how this is manipulated. We know what it turns into and stuff. And we know what can often be some of the end type of results in philosophies. But here Mansfield goes into the story of a soldier in need of religious justification. Let's see what he means.
I opened the book early on with the story of a young man whose name is not his own. I'm protecting him, but I call him in the book Lance Corporal James Galt. James Galt, all-American boy. Father is a farmer in Alabama. That part's true. High school football and basketball star, you know, the whole thing. Deeply influenced by the prayers of his football coach over the team, you know, that kind of a thing. Always dreamed of being a Marine. Loved the idea of being a Marine. Finally ends up, his life dream, he becomes a Marine fighting in Iraq. Well, his platoon goes out one day, his squad goes out one day, and they come under sniper fire in a village that they were moving into. James Galt looks up at the top of a three-story building, sees a sniper training down on his men, turns his 50-caliber machine gun towards this man, fires, and cuts him in half right at the waist. The man's torso falls to the street three stories below. His legs remain standing for a short while afterwards. The horror of this so shakes James Galt that even though he is a Christian, even though he's a man who goes into the field very much with a belief that what he calls righteous killing is appropriate, that there is, according to his Bible and according to Christian tradition, a legitimate conduct of war that makes killing in that war righteous, he is just undone by what he has wrought by his own hands. He's not backing away from his God, but he needs to renew the vision and the belief that he's doing good, that he is, in his terms, not mine, his terms, that he's a servant of God in what he is doing. This has always been his dream, to be a Marine for the glory of God. And he goes through a time of spiritual seeking. Now, I've learned that there are many different types of chaplains, and most of them are fantastic. Apparently, the one that James Galt talked to, when James Galt said, "Sir, please tell me that I'm on the side of God in what I'm doing, that I'm a servant of Christ in the conduct of this war," the chaplain didn't feel comfortable answering that with the affirmative, didn't feel comfortable addressing it in those terms. He said, "You know, we're Americans, we don't fight holy wars. I can tell you that if you'll trust in God, he'll help you be a good soldier and serve your country well." Do you understand that that's not quite what James Galt was going for? That was kind, that was fair, that was wise even, the chaplain's response wasn't quite what James Galt needed. He needed a tighter connection between faith and his exact conduct in war. He needed not so much a justification, but some belief about who he was and what his country was doing in Iraq that helped him to frame in moral terms what he was bringing about by his own hands. Now, eventually, he came awry, got the answers he needed, but his search is very, very typical of what a great many soldiers go through.
All right, so once again, you know, this exposes, this is where Mansfield wants the line of discussion to be on. When he talks about how this cat, you know, wanted, after doing what he did to this individual, he wanted and needed to renew within his mind that what he was doing was on the side of God. Now, you didn't hear Mansfield address, and quite naturally, is not going to be addressed within this sphere, any of the political, social, humanitarian issues that are involved with this discussion. Whether you quote-unquote see yourself on the side of God or not is irrelevant if it's not connected to other people's sovereignty. If it's not connected to the rights of other people's self-determination. So this whole, once again, onward Christian soldier structure is in alignment, like the onward Islamic soldier and onward, you know, expansionist Zionist soldier, is in alignment with the expansionist policies of the elites. This is what makes them imperialist. Now, to give like a another aspect of a historical type of perspective on this, you know, there's this cat, he's from Mauritania, an Arab cat. His name is Abdel Nasser Aoud Issa. And he has this thing about his journey from a slave owner to an abolitionist. Mauritania is right by Senegal and in Africa. And part of the article goes, legend has it that the classic American hymn Amazing Grace was composed by a slave master who suddenly saw the light and became an anti-slavery activist.
it goes into how Nasser, foreign secretary of the underground anti-slavery group SOS Slaves, in his native Mauritania, a small West African country just above Senegal, chattel slavery has existed for centuries. A ruling class of Arabo-Berber tribes known as the Danes, whites, holds black African slaves, abid, as inheritable property. The master-slave relationship, Yasser notes, touches all aspects of life in Mauritania. Yasser was born into the Bedane's ruling class and was surrounded by family slaves throughout his childhood, but intellectual exposure to the French Revolution and the Holocaust profoundly disrupted Yasser's worldview as a teenager. He promptly became an abolitionist and a democracy activist, a charismatic human rights leader largely reviled by the ruling elite in Mauritania. So then they ask him a couple of questions, and they ask him this: you are a member of the ruling Bedanes, an Arab-Berber ethnic group. Your family has held slaves for centuries, and slavery is an integral part of the society in which you grew up. So how did you become an anti-slavery activist? And Yissa says, quote, in high school, I read about the French Revolution and was fascinated by the books of Voltaire and Rousseau. The idea of the French Revolution, that all men are born equal, free and equal, captivated me, and I began to see that what was happening in my country was not normal. I would come home from school and slaves would care for me. They would bring me drinks, wash my hands, massage my feet, and cook for me. Then they asked, as a child, how did you relate to your family's slaves? Were there slaves your own age? And Yasser says, when children are young, there is not much difference between the slaves and the masters. As a young child, I had 5 slaves, but we mostly played together. But then at age 6, the social pyramid began. My friend Yibawa, a boy slave who was my own age, began to serve me. This seemed normal until I turned 16. Then they ask him about what happened at 16. Well, they ask him, why do slaves so often accept their position? And Yusuf says, slaves believe that if they do not obey their masters, they will not go to paradise. They are raised in a social and religious system that every day reinforces this idea. In society, a slave needs a master to protect him or her, to bring them to the hospital, to bring kids to school, to represent them in court. Slaves need a protector or intermediary to get by in Mauritanian society. The Bedanes run the government, the military, the courts, the schools. Slaves cannot revolt because they would lose everything. They can only hope for justice and legal protection if they have a master, unquote. Now, once again, this shows how religion plays a role in crucifying the minds of a slave. A slave who believes in the master's ways, in his a concept of paradise, in his religion, believes that if he resists against it or she resists against it, that they won't be in paradise land. See, this is how religion once again controls the minds of the slave. So then they ask, when did slavery begin in Mauritania? And Yasser states, quote, around 1000 AD, the Arab and Berber tribes came south to Islamize the Africans. The Africans were animists who worshipped the sun. Their land, by the way, used to be a very green, lush area. Now it's all desert. When the Africans resisted Islamicization, they were enslaved. This began centuries of chattel slavery, slavery that has not ended. We didn't learn this history in school. We simply grew up within the social hierarchy and lived it. I should also note that the Muslim missionaries found slavery within the African social context, within pockets of Mauritania's free black African population. This practice actually continued through the 1960s, but Mauritanian African society evolved more quickly as the French colonial influence was stronger. So African-on-African slavery gradually disappeared. However, all slaves in Mauritania are Muslims like their masters. So, once again, this gets into the aspect of another group coming in, disrupting the flow, and even within the kind of slave society that Africans were producing amongst one another, which all groups have done that. The term slave comes from the term Slav. Slavics were enslaved, largely by Arabs, on such high numbers that Slavs and slaves became synonymous. But this form of slavery, like in within Africa, was not overthrowing or and disrupting the society. As he said himself, the area was very green and lush. Now it's all desert. This is outsiders coming in and putting in their dominating the land for their own economic benefit, etc., etc. This is how this expansionism process works, and the devastating toll that it also has on the particular population. But last, let's get back to Mansfield as he outlines his goal for the book and what this all consists of. Check it out.
What I was attempting to do in the book was to help to extend this honor for the soldier that we have in our society. I'm very proud of our country. That even among those who aren't in favor of the war, we're still loving the soldier. My father fought in Vietnam. I remember very keenly him having to scrape the Army sticker off of our family station wagon before we moved to the next assignment when he came back from Vietnam, because that was an age in which people were literally spitting on soldiers as they returned from Vietnam. That's not what's happening in our society. I travel a lot. I see people applauding soldiers in airports. I see people in first class giving up their seats for soldiers in the back. It's a different culture. But I wanted to extend that honor, but also perhaps shine a light on the religious needs of soldiers, which have been pretty much the same throughout all generations, I think, in all wars. But with this generation, it's taken a little bit further. And there are some fascinating dynamics between the chaplains, the First Amendment, our current culture of faith, the unique nature of this battle that's bringing religion to the forefront. What may be happening is that what these soldiers are evolving in the field of a non-denominational, interdenominational, bare bones, let's just take care hold of God and get rid of all the fluff kind of thing, is that they are offering, they're showing us maybe the way to something new and something powerful when it comes to faith. A faith that's not just lived in luxury and materialism, but a faith that's hammered out in the face of death, and that is vital and is real, and that is what soldiers need. And it's my hope that not only we will drink from that, but that the military and our elected officials will be aware of how our current climate of indecision about the role of religion in our public life may not be serving our soldiers well. And it's time to focus on their religious needs, support the chaplains, and help soldiers integrate faith into that sort of faith-based warrior code that I reference in the book.
So once again, this just helps to expose how, all of this warrior code and proud of our country and all of that type of stuff, it's just wrapped within nationalism, imperialism, and you mix it in with your invisible kingdom and, supreme being tooth fairy belief, and you have a toxic mix that resonates from Boykin the General to Adolf Hitler to Mansfield to the government of Khartoum, the genocidal Sudanese government with their Arabic Islamic identity, to the government in Israel, to the slavers in Mauritania, all one big, happy, fanatical band of bandits, all in the name of religion, marching off like little soldiers to the gates of hell. Hold on a sec.
Thank you.
As we wrap this, about to wrap this up, I'm going to go into a few notes from Adraptomania. This is an article that's on the Slave Web. It's an article in a Muslim Wake Up, where their motto is, prayer is better than sleep. It's by Tariq Fatah. It goes like this. Her voice quivered, barely concealing her anger. Professor Amina Wadud's words bellowed across the hall. Quote, I am a nigger, and I can't do much about it, unquote, Wadud, who was speaking to a Toronto audience on Sunday, was responding to a questionnaire who asked her to address internalized racism within the Muslim community and if that had anything to do with the hostility she had faced from a section of the crowd. The 300 people who had packed Toronto's Norris Cultural Center to hear the internationally known scholar of the Quran and the role of women in Islam froze in stunned silence as they digested the impact of her words. Eyes piercing towards her hecklers, Wadud leaned forward and stared down a group of men at the back of the hall. Quote, usually I wear the hijab, and when I'm wearing it, most Muslims do not consider me African American. I pass off as South Asian, unquote, she said. But, quote, when they see me without a scarf, they can see my African locks, and they know I am black, and suddenly their attitude changes. The fact is I am a nigger, and you will just have to put up with my blackness, unquote. This time, part of the audience erupted in applause, cheering her every word. Others started walking out, hurling insults, and two men were heard jeering her, quote, you are just another CIA agent, unquote. Amina Wa'ad, professor of Islamic studies at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of Quran and Women, Reading the Sacred Text from a Woman's Perspective, was speaking as part of the series sponsored by York University and the Noor Cultural Center that has bought a number of academics to speak on the current state of Islam in the Muslim world. Wadud's reputation preceded her, resulting in standing room only in Toronto's most progressive mosque, the only place in Canada where men and women pray side by side in separate enclosures. Midway through her speech titled The Quran, Women and Interpretive Possibilities, Wadud waded into the minefield by addressing some difficult passages of the Quran. Breaking the ultimate taboo in the Muslim narrative, she stated that despite the fact the Quran explicitly asked for the cutting off of the hands of thieves, she did not agree with the Quran. She said she understood that this was a very difficult subject to talk about, but she would be dishonest to herself if she did not express her views. She maintained that as a Muslim with Allah close to her heart, in all honesty, she could not continue with the hypocrisy of lying about how she felt about some verses of the Quran. The basis of her talk was, quote, how to be God's agent on earth, to be a moral agent of the Creator, unquote. In this context, she presented four ways of looking at the Quranic verses which Muslims find difficulty dealing with. She identified the four methods as 1. The literal readings of the text. 2. The legalistic arguments that constrains how verses are applied. 3. Reinterpretation for alternative perspectives. And 4. Saying no to the Quran when one disagrees with it. Pursuing the last point, she declared that she could not intellectually or spiritually accept some things in the Quran, for example, some of the hudud punishment, like cutting off the hands or the permission to beat one's wife. She made it clear that she was denying neither the religion nor the revelation. Quote, it is the Quran, she said, that gives me the meaning to say no to the Quran, unquote. However, many of the audience were completely unprepared for her honesty. She had barely finished her talk when a long line of people lined up at the microphone to ask questions. One woman who identified herself as a professor of Arabic language at Toronto University took the mic and started lambasting Wadud, suggesting that she had come to her conclusion because she did not understand Arabic and that she had misread the Quran, saying, quote, you know only one verse of the Quran. Instead of a question, Wadud was subjected to a rant that was largely incomprehensible. The professor continued accusing Wadud of supporting illicit sex, when Wadad made no such reference. Quote, "This is the most idiotic nonsense I have ever heard," Wadad responded. When Amina Wadad referred to the 9/11 tragedy and the fact that some of the Muslims deemed it Islamic to crash planes into buildings and kill innocent people, a section of the crowd interrupted her. Quote, "What about Israel's killing Palestinians?" Unquote. They yelled. One middle-aged heckler said, quote, "She is a CIA agent." Unquote. Other men and women lined up at the mic to accuse her of all sorts of things. Another man, angered by Wadud's 9/11 remark, came to the mic and lectured her. Quote, "Let me remind you that no Muslim was involved in 9/11 attack." Unquote. Wadud did not dignify his remark with a response. I can go on and on, but this helps once again, because I know this type of stuff and seeing this type of stuff take place all the time. And me pointing out the Sudan situation, Mauritania situation, the lack of response by much of the Arab Muslim world, so on and so forth, shows the hierarchical and racist type of attitude in imagery that is going on. And often people push out these religions as something that can cleanse people of their racism and so on and so forth. Now, the only reason why I mention this in part and going over this hypocrisy is that, you know, the same way that Islam's, Christians, Hebrons, and all of that can challenge other ideologies, other positions, other organizations, other political formations, collective formations, you know, concepts of social gatherings, you know, it could be anarchy, it could be, you know, communistic, whatever, it's the same way that they have to be critiqued. There's nothing special about what they do that shouldn't be critiqued and understood. In other words, if we had a social gathering of pirate radio people within different collectives and stuff like that, and a woman got up to talk about there needs to be more participation within the pirate movement or whatever, and then all of a sudden people would start jumping up and saying, "You're CIA! You're CIA! You know, you just want to have illicit sex," and all of this type of stuff, people would see us for the kooks we would be. Well, the same holds with the various mystic traditions. The various sorcery traditions do the same. And their game plan and exposure on the race question, on the gender question, on questions of, you know, basic humanity, who's chopping off hands and all of that, and people don't want to hear someone questioning that, gives one indication of how stagnant these types of invisible man belief traditions can and really are. Hold on a sec. That as long as people allow themselves to get caught up into being basically missionaries of imperial crusade for the masters, they'll continue to be confining themselves into creating a true hell on planet Earth and never know what it's really like to be a slave in revolt and to blow truly wild in the wind. Until the next time, slave revolt.